It's time to go back in time.
He's fighting Mickey Gall next weekend, who has a 2-0 professional mixed martial arts record. So I'm going to go ahead and make a prediction for this fight right now. I predict that Mickey Gall will beat CM Punk in the first round of their fight by submission. Probably by rear naked choke.
Ladies and gentlemen, referee Keith Peterson has called a stop to this contest at 2 minutes, 14 seconds of the very first round, declaring the winner by submission due to a rear naked choke, Mickey Gall!
I am the smartest man alive!
It's business time, baby.
The Solid Monster sounds off.
My client, Elite Brock Lesnar, conquered the streak.
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
He's fat. You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
Welcome to episode 460 of the Solid Monster Sounds Off here for Sunday, September 11th, 2016. I am the Solid Monster. On this, the 15-year anniversary of the 9/11 terror attacks. Actually, before I started recording here, I was kind of glued to MSNBC has this simulcast of the Today Show from that morning. So right down to the minute that everything actually happened, they were replaying the entire original broadcast from that morning in 2001. And it's crazy to think 15 years have gone by. I mean, you feel that way because you don't actively think about it. So when you don't actively think about something, and then one day you think of it, it's like, oh my God, I can't believe that much time has gone by. 15 years, though, that's nuts. I mean, most everybody who was alive at that time in this country remembers where they were and what they were doing at the exact moment that all of this was going down. I was still in college. I was actually in my dorm getting ready to go to class, had the TV on, was watching all of this unfold. And I remember walking to class, and as soon as I walked into the building that I was going to, I was a communications major, so right in the lobby of the building, they had a television kind of hanging from the ceiling, and there's a whole crowd of people, teachers, students, gathered around the TV watching what was going on and just bawling their eyes out. And I figured at that point, probably not going to be having class today, and sure enough, you know, once I went into class, the teacher came rushing in after a few minutes and just didn't know what to do and dismissed all of us. And we were all glued to our TVs for the rest of the day. And things have never really been the same. So it's a very sad day. I think it's very easy to kind of, as there's more distance between what happened then and today, it becomes easier to not minimize it or forget about it, but it kind of, in some eyes, it might become less of a big deal. It's just kind of something that happened. But you look at the way the world has changed, and you could trace it all back to that one event. And I don't just mean in this country. I mean all over the world, all the decisions that have been made. It's just, you could really separate the world into, it's like a BC-AD kind of thing when it comes to 9/11. How things were and how things changed after that day. It's unbelievable. It's just unbelievable. So it's a sad day, but it's also been a very newsworthy week. A very bizarre week. CM Punk fought his first UFC fight, and Tim Tebow signed a contract with the New York Mets. And I always said, you know, the Mets were only one good quarterback away from a World Series title. So we might be, maybe that was the missing ingredient. We haven't won a championship since 86. We got a quarterback now, so maybe that'll help us. They signed him to a minor league deal to play in their, I guess, in their instructional league. So, you know, basically they're starting him out in NXT before they send him up to the main roster. You know, honestly, people were tweeting me like, oh, I hope you talk about this on the show. I can't wait to hear what you think about this. Honestly, as a PR guy, I think it's a win-win. I really don't think there's anything wrong with it. I mean, first of all, if the guy's actually any good, you know, maybe they get something out of him. Chances are he's not, right? If he's not good, and he hasn't played baseball since high school, apparently. I think his junior year of high school. You know what? They'll still sell a ton of tickets to their minor league games. I know, I think Sandy Alderson came out, the GM, and said, oh, we didn't do this for marketing reasons. Give me a break. And they know that. They know that you know, if he actually gets promoted to one of their minor league teams, he's going to be an attraction. I don't know how long it'll last. Probably not very long. But they'll sell a ton of tickets to their minor league games, absolutely. I mean, I would even say there's a good chance he'll end up playing here in Brooklyn for the Cyclones, which is like the low A-ball team for the Mets. It's only too bad that he missed the cutoff because the Mets can't call him up here. Mets are in the playoff chase. I mean, they're headed possibly for a wild card berth. They're still very much in it. And it's just a shame. Can you imagine them going back to the World Series this year? Game 7, bottom of the 9th, and they call Tim Tebow off the bench and he hits a monster home run to win them a championship? I mean, it sounds far-fetched. Obviously, it can't happen now, but the whole scenario sounds far-fetched. It really, you know, I don't know how far-fetched it really is. You never know what might happen with this guy. What a story that would be. All it took was Tim Tebow for the Mets to win a World Series. So yeah, very bizarre week. Before we get into all the news, Audible, still offering listeners of this podcast the chance to sample their service free for 30 days. All you got to do is use our link, audibletrial.com/solomonster. Go through the sign-up process. You will not be billed. You will have 30 days to see if you like it. They've got over 180,000 audiobooks to choose from, wrestling, non-wrestling. Pretty much it runs the gamut. If you don't like the service for any reason, and I don't think you'll dislike it. Audible, they've got a great service. They've been around for a while. People rave about them, and if you want to check it out, I would ask you to use our link because you're helping the podcast out when you do so. The cool thing about it is you get one free audiobook. So as soon as you go through the sign-up process and you've got your trial up and running, you can pick your first book for free on us. Whatever book it may be, you can get it for free. And if you happen to cancel your trial before the 30 days are up so you don't get billed, you get to keep that book no matter what. That book belongs to you. On us. So audibletrial.com/solomonster. Hopefully we'll end the year strong with the signups here as we head toward the end of 2016. It's been a great relationship with Audible. Let's keep that going. Also, showing some love for our store on Pro Wrestling Tees. ProWrestlingTees.com/solomonster sounds off. We've got over 24 shirts in the store. And I love getting photos from you guys wearing the shirts. I will share them with everyone if you tweet them to me. So once you get your shirt in the mail, you want to throw that thing on and send a photo on over. I'd be more than happy to share that with the rest of the world. And last but not least, if you want to become a PayPal VIP, which is the easiest and most direct way to show your support for the podcast, you can go on thesolomonster.com. Thesolomonster.com, you'll see the PayPal button on the right-hand side. Just click that button and you can make a donation of any amount at any time, whatever you're able to do, whatever you feel comfortable with. Of course, $10 or more will get you a wrestling nickname and a shout-out here on this podcast, which is listened to all over the world every single week. $30 or more, if you can get a shout-out for your own podcast or your business, just you know, send that information along. I want to say thank you this week to Marteus Feaster, John Loose Cannon Lopez, Yvonne Bruiser Balak, Beast Mode, Brock Joseph, Deadpool, James Herrera, Hot Stuff, Hector Pena, Misfit, Miguel Mendoza, Dream Chaser, Chauncey Curry, The Chosen Son, Andre Smith, Timu, The Tyrant, Asa Kanan, Kind of a Big Deal, Corey Blake, Nemesis, Nathan Moyers, The Philly Fanatic, Caliph Kane, Destruction, Jamie Dorsch, High Society, Thurman Taylor IV, First Class, LT Gilberry, Edwin Pretty Boy Palenzuela, Virginia Glory, Gregory Gilbert, The Tennessee Titan, Charles Lindsay, The Sin City Superstar, Peter Sanders, Vince the Vanguard Favreau, The Dublin Destroyer, Robert Cummins, Mass Grave, Micah Harshaw, and Hell's Angel, Holly Shims. Thank you very much to everybody who made a PayPal donation and became one of our VIPs this week. Now, last week, we kicked off a new countdown here on the podcast. We've done a few countdowns. This one is timed to coincide. It will climax in November for our 9-year anniversary podcast. So we're doing 9 weeks ranked from last to best or least best to most best. I don't know how you want to phrase it. of what are my favorite, in my opinion, the top nine promos, interviews in WWE history. We're limiting this to WWE only simply because there were so many great ones on my original list that were non-WWE that there simply wasn't room to include all of them. And last week, we kicked things off with number nine, which was the Vince McMahon Life Sucks and Then You Die promo. I can't even do it the way he does. But the Life Sucks promo from SmackDown in 2000. And so we're going to have number eight later in the show. Another great one, one of my favorites. We'll talk about that a little bit later. We've got to lead off talking about CM Punk. Last night, UFC 203, CM Punk finally, after 2 years, two long years, made his much-anticipated UFC debut, UFC 203, against Mickey Gall. Now, you heard the audio at the beginning of the podcast. Last week, I made a prediction. I predicted that Mickey Gall would win in the first round via submission, which, you know, is not all that unrealistic to think that he would win by submission. It's not like it's such a bold prediction, but I did say it would probably be by rear naked choke. And sure enough, Mickey Gall wins via submission in round number one, 2 minutes and 14 seconds of round number one, with the rear naked choke. So, went pretty much exactly as I figured it would be. It was ugly. It was an ugly fight, ugly for CM Punk. It was, you know, look, it took guts. It took guts to go in there and to do this. To do everything that he's gone through. I mean, this guy's been going through hardcore training. He's been getting his ass kicked. And he's put in the time. Again, it's taken 2 years. He had to have back surgery, so he went through the back surgery. And to step into that cage, I don't care who you are. I really don't care who you are, how old you are, what your background is, how big or how small you are. But especially for a guy, this is not his trade. You know, he is not a fighter. He may like fighting. He can try to be a fighter. And who knows, maybe he'll win a fight one day. But CM Punk is not a fighter, right? He was a pro wrestler for pretty much of his life. He was a pro wrestler. And pro wrestling, for all the similarities it has to MMA, is not mixed martial arts. It is not the same thing. Stepping inside Hell in a Cell against The Undertaker is not the same thing as stepping into a UFC cell, if you want to call it that, against somebody who's going to punch your face in. Which is exactly what Mickey Gall did. In fact, when the fight was over, CM Punk already had a cauliflower ear. I mean, he looked like he had gotten his ass kicked. When the fight was over, he was bearing the scars of battle. Why did I call it the scars of battle? I sound like Matt Hardy now. He was bearing the battle scars. The scars of battle. That's a weird way of putting it. But he looked like he took a pretty hellacious beating. But it took guts. I still say it took guts. And I know there's a lot of people who don't like CM Punk. I know... there is a lot of hate for CM Punk for various reasons, and I know CM Punk is not the most likable guy in the world and probably not the easiest guy to get along with, and he comes off as a dick, but it still took guts to get in there and try it and to do it. And, you know, he walked in there against a brown belt, and he survived over 2 minutes. It's not like it was over in 30 seconds. It's not like it was a flash knockout or he immediately put him in a choke and tapped him out in 10 seconds. I mean, for whatever it's worth, as ugly as it was, he still survived over 2 minutes. In there against the brown belt in his very first fight. The fact is, he's going to get cut. I mean, there's no doubt. CM Punk is going to... Even Dana White's already said he probably shouldn't be fighting in the UFC. He didn't come right out and say that CM Punk would never fight again in the UFC or that he would cut him, but they're going to cut him. I mean, there's no doubt in my mind. I don't see how UFC does not cut Punk. I don't... You know, whatever deal they signed him to for however many fights, how can he fight again? I mean, maybe one day... with some experience under his belt in the amateur ranks, they will give him a look. I'm not saying he'll never, ever fight in UFC again, but how could they bring him back for a second fight after this? He probably shouldn't have had a first fight. I mean, let's be honest here. He already got special treatment by being given this fight. When was the last time UFC brought in somebody with a 0-0 record to fight on one of their pay-per-views? In what was really, let's be honest, the co-main event on the show. So they extended that you know, privilege to him. They obviously saw something in him. They could get something out of it. They knew there would be a lot of hoopla, a lot of publicity around it. It was a smart move to make on UFC's part. I guess if you're you know, like an MMA purist, you probably didn't like this very much. But, you know, it's still a business. They made a business decision to sign CM Punk, and probably more so sign him so that Bellator or somebody couldn't get their hands on him. But at this point, they got to cut him. They have no choice. So I expect he'll be cut. And he says he's serious about fighting again. That was the key message when the fight was over. He said, even though he got his ass kicked, he had the time of his life, and he will fight again. And there are plenty of amateur MMA leagues that will gladly take him, and he can go ply his craft there. But as a one-time attraction, it made sense for the UFC to take a chance on the guy. But he just got absolutely demolished. I mean, he was wrecked. I'm being very nice when I say, well, you know, he was in there with a brown belt and he survived 2 minutes, and he did. But I'm going out of my way to be generous about this, because there really was nothing positive about what happened to him inside that cage. I don't know what specific injuries he has. I don't know if he's concussed or what. His ear was just completely fucked up. Probably more just banged and bruised, and I'm sure he's feeling it this morning. And it was interesting in the post-fight speech. It was not the CM Punk that you would expect. This was a very contrite CM Punk. This was a CM Punk that was smiling and saying he had the time of his life. It was the best night of his life, other than the night he married his wife, which is a smart thing for him to say, by the way. And he goes into this speech about how you gotta, you know, ignore the haters and believe in yourself, even if it's a teacher or somebody tells you can't do something or they put you down. You've got to block the hate and ignore the hate. And no matter how many times you get knocked down, it's about how many times you get back up. This guy went full on John Cena on us. I was waiting for him to start talking about hustle, loyalty, and respect. Of course, he did drop an F-bomb in here, but you know, otherwise you would hear this and you would think, what is this guy? He's trying to be John Cena? It was a very inspirational speech, but not the CM Punk that one would expect. But what are you going to say? I mean, this guy just got embarrassed in front of the world. I mean, maybe he doesn't see it that way. He made it a lot further than most people would. He got to fight in the UFC, but, you know, he was embarrassed. I watched part of the post-fight press conference later on. This guy was in tears. I mean, he was literally crying. He was so emotional. He was so embarrassed, and I don't know if ashamed is the right word, but he clearly was unhappy that he lost. He didn't expect that he would lose, at least not this badly. He's sitting there. His eyes are all red. He can barely speak. I felt bad for the guy. You know, but credit to him. He went in there. This is what he wanted to do. This was a dream of his, and he realized that dream, and it pretty much went exactly as everybody thought it would. He did come out to Cult of Personality. I was kind of holding out hope he might come out to Miseria Cantare, his old song from Ring of Honor. I guess both of these songs are old songs from Ring of Honor. I mean, he used Cult of Personality there, too. Place went nuts for him using the song. It was a cool moment. He even took a moment before he stepped inside the cage to survey the building and look around, and that was, I'm sure, a moment for him. So good for him. You know, this was an interesting show, even beyond the CM Punk fights. When the Punk fight ended, and again, it was very quick, you know, a little over 2 minutes, he got wrecked. So I watched the rest of the show, and the next fight they had Fabricio Werdum and Travis Brown. And this fight was more pro wrestling than anything CM Punk has done since joining the UFC, in terms of his own fight, in terms of promos. I mean, this was not the CM Punk I think UFC was probably expecting when they signed him. He didn't shake Mickey Gall's hand at the press conference, but aside from that, there was nothing controversial that he did, nothing controversial that he said. For a guy who, you know, was known for dropping pipe bombs and all this kind of stuff, it was a pretty sanitized version of CM Punk. Pretty laid back. And I think part of that is because he knew, I can't run my mouth here and go out there and get embarrassed. He had to know in the back of his mind there was a decent chance that he was going to go out there and just get smashed. And it would have made things worse for him if he was going around talking shit all week, and then he goes out there and gets, you know, beaten in a minute. So I think he knew that. But I'm watching this fight. As soon as this fight opens, Werdum goes for a fucking flying super kick. And he went for like a whole bunch of like roundhouse kicks, spinning heel kicks. He's doing all this like flippy shit in this fight. And then, you know, Travis Brown gets hit on the hand, and he basically calls a timeout in his own fight. And the announcers are going on and on about how that's illegal, you're not supposed to be able to do that, the fight should be stopped, and yet they let the fight go on. And, you know, Werdum won, and as soon as the fight's over, I mean, I'm watching this and I'm going, you know, this guy's out there, and he delivers a front kick to his opponent's coach, who was kind of baiting him on. The opponent, you know, the opponent's coach was like yelling at him. He fucking kicked this guy, gave this guy a front kick, and then he follows it up with his post-fight, you know, winning promo by going on an anti-drinking and driving PSA. That's the quickest heel to face turn I've ever seen. This whole thing was wild. I was more thoroughly entertained by that fight in the post-fight than anything that happened in the CM Punk fight. So UFC, you pretty much morphed into the WWE on this show. And CM Punk had absolutely nothing to do with any of it, which is kind of ironic. In a move that comes as a surprise to absolutely no one, WWE and Alberto Del Rio parted ways this week. They put out a statement saying they have mutually agreed upon the terms of his release. Del Rio then tweeted out, "My business relationship with WWE has come to an end. In good terms," he says. "Thanks for the opportunities they gave me." I saw Del Rio's lawyer, one of his lawyers, tweeted out his thanks to WWE for letting his client go. So it seems publicly they want this to be over on the best of terms. No bad blood, no ill will. Even though clearly he was obviously very upset, he was not happy with what the company was doing with him, and I'm sure he's not happy about what's going on with his girlfriend, which I'll talk about here in a second. So this guy, he has a press conference. Del Rio calls a press conference for Friday. And I shit you not, he has this press conference at a Hooters in Mexico City. And if you look at the background of some of the photos, it's a Hooters, and maybe all Hooters are like this. I don't know. I've not been in a Hooters in a while. But in the background, you see they have one of those ball pit play thingies for kids. It's not like a bouncy castle, but it's kind of like that. Right behind them. Like, you know, it's like, it's so... You talk about amateur hour. This is amazing. I'm watching this guy. Alberto Del Rio has now quit WWE, and he's sitting in a Hooters in Mexico holding a press conference. Paige is sitting at another table looking like she's there being held hostage. She wasn't interviewed. Nobody talked to her. She didn't say a word. She looked completely thrilled from the one photo I saw to be there, and I'm being sarcastic when I say that. I'm looking at that, and I'm going, what must be going through this girl's mind? She's sitting there by herself at a Hooters in Mexico. I mean, she's got to be just thinking, how did I get here? How did this happen? Because it sounds like she may be on her way out of the company, too. There's rumors that she already quit the company, which has not been confirmed. Those are just rumors. Rumors that she's retained legal representation, which does sound legit, that she has she's gotten some lawyers. She's trying to get out of her contract. Her contract still has a few years, like 2 or 3 years left on it. I said a few weeks ago when I talked about this whole thing, people made a whole big stink about them being together and, oh, she's got to break up with him. This is wrong and all this other stuff. And I said at the time, just live and let live. You know, it's not like there's a 30 or 40 year age difference. I think there's a line that probably would be too much even for me. Yeah, he's older. He's an older guy. But, I mean, live and let live. You know, if she's happy with him and they're not causing problems behind the scenes, then it's none of WWE's business. But having said that, and seeing the way things are going here, I hope she knows what she's doing here. You know, she 24? She's a young girl. She's putting her career in jeopardy for this one guy. And this is a guy that'll be just fine. He'll go back to Mexico. He'll work, you know, all these different promotions all over the world. He's already made a lot of money. He'll be fine. She's 24 years old. Even though she hasn't been doing much lately, she only debuted... When did she debut? Was it 2 years ago? I don't even know if it was 3 years. It was probably 2 years ago. I think it was the night after WrestleMania in New Orleans, I think, is the night that she made her debut. So she hasn't been around for that long. And she's putting her entire career in jeopardy for, you know, Alberto Del Rio. I mean, if that's what she wants, then more power to her. But I would not be looking to burn any bridges if I were her. If she's retained a lawyer and this is going to get all nasty, you know, if I'm her, I'm not looking to burn any bridges. She's only 24. She loves wrestling. The girl was born to wrestle. It's in her blood. It's in her family. Her parents still wrestle. If she leaves, she will be back at some point. She will be back. I mean, it's just inevitable. But a lot of that depends on how things get worked out here. So if she really wants out, then do what you got to do. But, you know, hopefully she's mature enough to not say the wrong thing or do anything stupid and, you know, fuck up the rest of her life. Because that would be a shame. People had high hopes for Paige when she came in. She used to be the belle of NXT for a little while. Of course, when you come to the main roster and they kind of de-emphasize you, which happens to everyone. It's even happening now, you could say, to some of the other women they've brought up. You know, it happens. You kind of fall out of the spotlight a little bit. It's tough because she's so young. Like, you think to yourself, when she first came up, she was 22 or 23. You figure, okay, if she could stay healthy, this girl has another... I mean, this girl could wrestle for another 20 years if she wants to, or more. I mean, her mother is, what, in her mid-40s, and she's still wrestling in England? But, like, you're in WWE. How do you stay relevant, right? How do you keep people interested in you for that long? I mean, I think it's actually a big negative when you have somebody that young make their debut. And I think it's worse with the women, because the women, you can talk about this women's revolution and all this nonsense. Okay, you know, it might be better now than it used to be. But the fact is, the women are still not a feature, like a real top feature attraction on this show. In a lot of ways, they still feel like second-class citizens, right? It's you got the men, you got the guys in the top programs, and then you have the women beneath that. So it's not like the women are getting, you know, 3, 4, 5 different segments on a single show. It's not like they're headlining pay-per-views. At some point, they might. I'm sure they will. In fact, I expect them to. But it's going to be like, it'll be a novelty-type attraction. It's not like when it finally happens, I expect WWE is going to start headlining pay-per-views on a regular basis with the women, because they're not. It's just not going to happen that way. So the women are already at a disadvantage. If you're that young and you've already been around and people are kind of getting tired of you, what do you do? Like, creatively, what can you possibly do? I mean, does Paige turn into the Big Show where over the next 10 years you just turn her 15,000 times? It's hard. It's hard to keep people, you know, to keep these women relevant, I think, because they're already at a disadvantage. And so Paige, I guess she's been hurt. There's been other things going on, but she hasn't really been featured in anything meaningful in, I don't even know how long. I mean, months and months and months. So you look at it from a different perspective. If she can keep things civil between her and the company and they let her go, maybe it's the best thing for her. Maybe for her to go away for a little while. And look, I don't think this thing with Del Rio is going to last. How long it'll go on for, who knows? I don't think this is going to last very long. At some point, it's going to come to an end. And at some point, she's going to want to come back to WWE. Maybe being away would be the best thing for her. Maybe she goes away and comes back in 2 or 3 years and she feels fresh, or she has a different look. The landscape is different. She has different people to work with now. You know, absence makes the heart grow fonder. She comes back and she's the biggest babyface now in the women's division. Wouldn't necessarily be the worst thing for her to go away for a while. But just don't, you know, I think there's a way to handle it and a way to not handle it. Hopefully she's smart enough to handle it the right way. And hopefully she doesn't let this completely ruin her career. I mean, there are other places to work. I'm not saying WWE is the end-all, be-all. Even in the UK. I mean, the UK is going through a big wrestling boom. Paige can go back to the UK, and I'm sure she could be, you know, a big-time superstar over there for a while. And then in a few years, she can come back. You know, that might be the way to go. But the press conference itself that Del Rio had, very uneventful. I mean, he really didn't say anything of substance. He had mentioned, or somebody had said the day before when he first called the press conference, that he would address the wellness suspension. He didn't say anything about the wellness suspension. He didn't say what it was for. It never came up. I guess at this point it doesn't really matter since he's gone. He said he wasn't happy in WWE anymore. It was killing his passion for wrestling. He said he's free to work in Mexico immediately. In the U.S., it's going to be another 30 days or so before he can work somewhere else. He has already announced his first independent date, and it just so happens to be in Paige's hometown of Norwich, England, for the WAW promotion, which is run by Paige's father, Ricky Knight. So now he can meet the parents. He said he'll be using the El Patron name again, since WWE owns the Del Rio name. He does not plan on being exclusive anywhere, so he's going to bounce around from one place to another. He's in talks with, you know, all the major promotions in Mexico, CMLL, AAA, and he said he wants to retire from wrestling in the next 2 years. Claims that he's in talks to be a president for an MMA promotion, and that was it. Yeah, that was really it. I mean, it sounds like it's as amicable a split with him in the company as it could be, at least publicly. The situation with Paige may not be so amicable, and she's got to be really careful with that, because she's got a lot more years left in wrestling than he does. So I think she's got to be a little selfish here and look out for herself. Backlash is tonight, the first SmackDown-only pay-per-view, live from Richmond, Virginia. This is the first Backlash show since 2009. I went back and I looked at that lineup, and that was a show that had Chris Jericho beating Ricky Steamboat. Had a match between Matt and Jeff Hardy, so some things never change. And Edge beating John Cena in a last man standing match. So they have a six-pack challenge tonight to crown a new SmackDown Women's Champion. Nikki Bella, Becky Lynch, Natalya, Naomi, Alexa Bliss, and Carmella. It's a six-pack challenge elimination match. I know it's inevitable Nikki will have the title at some point. I think it's time Becky gets a run of her own. Long overdue. The only one of the four horsewomen to never win the NXT Women's title. And since she's been up on the main roster, she hasn't even been close to having her own run with the title. She was, I guess, in the triple threat of WrestleMania, but she fell short. And I think it's time also because you'll need a babyface in that spot for when Eva Marie eventually returns and gets the title. And you know she will. You know she will. Although it may be a while. Her suspension, quick Eva Marie note here, her suspension is up, I think, in about, probably what, like a week or two? But I saw that she is starring in her first feature film. And it's not the kind of film I'm sure a lot of you were thinking. But she is part of the cast for a thriller called Inconceivable. Which has Nicolas Cage as the lead. Nicolas Cage and Eva Marie in the same movie. Starts filming next month, so if that's the case, she's probably going to have to take more time off to go film the movie. I guess it depends on how big her role is. Maybe if she's a... I don't know what she'll be playing in the movie, but it doesn't sound like a big role. It's Nicolas Cage and Faye Dunaway. They have top billing, and Eva's like fourth from the top. I saw on SE Scoops that she dyed her hair black recently, so maybe it was for the movie role, but she'll be back eventually, and I think the person for her to... And look, I'm not saying I want to see Eva Marie beat Becky Lynch to win the championship, but I do think Becky Lynch should win this match. I think Becky Lynch is going to win. She's my pick. I think you give her a run with it, and then eventually if somebody like Eva beats her, because I think Becky is so well-liked, you know, the hope is that it'll put that much more heat on Eva when she finally takes it from her. So Becky's my pick. Now, on SmackDown, I may as well just weave my SmackDown thoughts into the predictions here. They had American Alpha beat the Usos literally in a minute to advance to the finals of the tag team title tournament, which is very disappointing. I was looking forward to that match. But then came the long overdue Usos heel turn, and that made me feel a little bit better, knowing that these two teams are probably going to end up having 1,000 matches together anyway, especially since there aren't that many other tag teams on this show. When you really look at the number of teams and who the teams are, this tag team division is very weak. You've got, you know, the Hype Bros and the Vaude Villains and, you know, Yong Gag Snore. I mean, this is not a strong tag team division on this show. Yeah, look, there's talented guys in there. Nobody was a bigger, you know, fan of Tyler Breeze than I was, and it's very obvious they don't see him above a certain level, so he's doing his thing, and he's got a little entertaining act going with Fandango, but it's not like they're ever going to be a featured team. They're just kind of there. Just like, you know, on the Raw brand, the Shining Stars. Ooh, they got their first big win on Raw Monday night. Who cares? They're not doing anything with these guys. They've got to get some guys going to give them a little bit of juice, but these are never going to be teams that are featured or champions or doing anything meaningful, so who really cares? So these two teams are going to end up having a gazillion matches together, which is cool, because I think they'll have some good matches. So the Usos went to shake their hands. They attacked them instead. They drop-kicked Chad Gable's leg. One of the Usos came off the top with a knee, with a splash onto the knee. They cut a heated promo backstage with Renee Young about how they haven't been getting any respect for years now. And, you know, all I can say is at least they finally gave us some sort of Samoan heel turn. I think it's the best thing for these guys. They've been around a long time. It kind of goes to what I was saying before about Paige and how maybe going away and then coming back will be the best thing for her. The Usos have been on TV nonstop for years. And, you know, they've got a lot of fans, but after a while it just gets boring, you know? It gets dull when you do the same thing over and over and over again. Look at John Cena. Now, it worked for John Cena because he was the top ticket seller, so he can get away with just doing the same shit over and over again. But it's a big part of why people turned against the guy. So I think turning the Usos will be a great thing for them. It'll freshen them up. Change can be a good thing. And on Talking Smack after the show, Shane McMahon announced that Chad Gable is going to be out 2 to 4 weeks with an injury, which means American Alpha is off the Backlash card. So instead, they're going to have what they're calling a second chance challenge with the Usos, who lost to American Alpha, meeting the Hype Bros, who lost to Slater and Rhino. So basically the two losers. And the winner of that match will then meet Heath Slater and Rhino in the finals to crown the first ever SmackDown Tag Team Champions. Slater and Rhino is who I want to see win. And, you know, I suppose you could have Jason Jordan and Chad Gable on crutches, you know, come down to the ring and distract the Usos and help Slater and Rhino win. You could do that, but I don't think it's going to happen. I am picking the Usos to win the titles. I think it puts more heat on them if they're going to be the top heel team on that brand. They lost in less than a minute on TV, which is fine as long as they're getting some of that heat back, and I think the way to do that is to put the titles on them. And I think it then makes the chase more meaningful when Jordan and Gable come back. They had to be the favorites to win this whole thing, and so when they come back, they should want to be going after the tag team titles. And part of it also is I just think if that's going to be the main tag team feud, you could put the belts on Slater and Rhino. Again, there's nobody else for them to challenge. You've got the Vaudevillains and the Hype Bros and you know, Fabriz. That's it. So I think you put the titles on the Usos, American Alpha comes back in a few weeks, and you build to that first tag team title match between them at, I guess it would be No Mercy. I think No Mercy is the next SmackDown pay-per-view. So the Usos are my pick. That would mean that Slater does not get a SmackDown contract, but you know that in the end he's getting a contract anyway. He's still going to get that contract somehow, some way. He'll be fine. By the way, was it me or did Shane McMahon on Talking Smack, he looked like he just didn't want to be there. He looked completely disinterested in being on that show. Like, Daniel Bryan has this great personality. Him and Renee have this great chemistry. And they bring in Shane, and he makes this announcement, and they're trying to talk to him and ask him some things, and, you know, he just looked like he would rather be anywhere but there. You know, it's like, I bet if you sent him to a sneaker convention, he'd light up like a fucking Christmas tree. But he just didn't care about being on this show. And speaking of Talking Smack, I loved how Daniel Bryan, when discussing the finish to SmackDown where AJ Styles kicked Dean Ambrose in the balls, he actually used the word balls and they bleeped it out. Twice they bleeped it out. On a show that's called Talking Smack, which airs on their own network. It's ridiculous. We have Colonel Sanders against the Chicken for the Intercontinental title. I'm picking the Chicken. I mean, why even bother putting the title on Ziggler? You know what I mean? Like, Miz actually has a little bit of momentum right now coming off that promo. 150 days or whatever it is as the Intercontinental Champion, and just keep it on him until somebody comes along who could actually benefit from being. Dolph Ziggler, here's another example of somebody who's been on TV, he's been around for so long, and he's super talented and should have gotten more than he did. I fully believe that. But here's a guy who's been on TV nonstop now for, what, a decade? And start and stop and start and stop and start and stop. And you put the Intercontinental title on him here, okay, so what? What does it mean? What does it mean? Miz at least has some juice right now. He's actually got something going. I see no benefit in taking the title of Miz just to put it on Dolph Ziggler. And the thing is, if you don't put it on Apollo Crews, and they pretty much ran that into the ground, the Miz has beaten Apollo Crews now twice. He has pinned him twice with his move in the middle of the ring. That feud is done. Apollo Crews does not deserve another match for the Intercontinental title. So, if not Apollo Crews, I'm looking at that SmackDown roster, and I have absolutely no idea who that person would be. Who that person would be that could benefit, and who it would make sense to program with The Miz for the Intercontinental Championship. I can't think of a single other babyface on that roster who could or who should take it from The Miz. Maybe that person has yet to be called up from NXT and they'll end up on SmackDown. I don't know. The only thing I could think is they could wait for Shelton Benjamin to heal up. But, you know, I didn't realize he only first had his shoulder surgery this week. I thought he already had it a few weeks ago. Apparently not. So he's going to be gone for a while, if they even bring him back at all. So I just say keep it on The Miz. He's my pick. Randy Orton and Bray Wyatt. I'm not feeling this match. I am not feeling this match. I know I want to see Bray get a big win, simply because it feels like forever since he's gotten one. I can't remember the last big singles win that Bray Wyatt got. I don't know how far off Luke Harper is from being cleared. I know he's on his way back soon. And I read some reports that, you know, he's first going to be at the Performance Center this week to train some more and see how he's progressing. You know, maybe he's already been cleared and that's just a cover story. I'm going to take a shot in the dark here. It may be a little early, but I think Luke Harper comes back. I think he makes the surprise return, and I think he helps Bray win. So Bray Wyatt is my pick for this match. And then we have the main event. Short show. Was that five matches? Dean Ambrose and AJ Styles for the WWE World Championship on SmackDown. These two had a face-to-face to end the show. I liked Ambrose's line in his promo about how they don't give out trophies for the face that comes in second place. I thought that was a great line. Styles kicked him in the nuts to end the show. Styles has to win the title. If not here, then next month in the rematch at No Mercy, but he has to win the title, and I think he wins it here. I'm going to predict that they're not going to wait that long. I think this is the show where he wins the championship. I'm picking AJ Styles. He has been absolutely fantastic, and Dean Ambrose he stepped up his game on promos. I'll give him that, but he's not done anything for me. He's just not. I mean, that SummerSlam match had a good build to it. And they completely shit the bed. I did not like that match at all. I thought that match was such a disappointment. And I'm not even saying it's his fault. Maybe they had a 20-minute match planned out and they got their time cut before they walked out. I don't know, and I don't care. All I know is coming out of that show, I was not impressed by them at all. And everything else they've had him doing, he's just kind of falling under the radar. I mean, this is your WWE champion. Didn't take very long for that Universal title, you know, crappy as it may look, to already become the A number one belt in this company. Already SmackDown in many ways has been relegated as the B show. Which is funny because on most weeks I think SmackDown is much easier to watch than Raw. I just think it's overall a better show. But it's obvious that SmackDown is clearly positioned as the number two show. And Dean Ambrose's stock it's fallen. I mean, it's not where it was even just a few months ago. And I think it's time for a change. I think it's time for AJ Styles to get a good run. I've enjoyed heel corny AJ on TV. I think he's really knocked it out of the park. I can't say a bad word about this guy. I can't say a bad word about his promos lately. I can never say a bad word about his matches. You know, he's doing everything that would be expected of him. He is the star of SmackDown. It's not Dean Ambrose. AJ Styles is the star of SmackDown. The star of SmackDown should be the champion. And that's your Backlash card. It's a 3-hour show. People have been asking me, is Backlash 2 hours? Because there's only five men. No, it's 3 hours, plus pre-show and post-show and all that shit. I would imagine they're going to end up adding a couple more matches at the last minute. They have to. I mean, they have to add some more matches. You know, take Apollo Crews and put him in a match, or Baron Corbin and Kalisto or something. I'm sure they'll add something like that to the show. But what they have here is not a 3-hour show. Unless Randy Orton walks extra slow to the ring, and we've seen him walk pretty slow to the ring before, they're going to have to stretch this out a little bit. Raw, from this past Monday night, was live from Kansas City, Missouri. Raw Instapoll, over almost 2,200 votes. 30% thumbs up, 70% thumbs down. I will say that the first hour of the show was perfectly fine. Mick Foley gave a passionate speech backstage to Stephanie McMahon after questioning whether or not she knew Triple H was going to come out and do what he did the week before, and she swore up and down, I knew nothing about it. She's pleading with Mick Foley to believe her. And Foley tells the story about the very first time he ever met Stephanie was backstage after his Hell in a Cell match with The Undertaker. She was the girl with the shy smile. Maybe that could be the title for her next book. I heard that Lady Balls got rejected, and now her book has been delayed. So maybe that could be the title. They can call it The Girl with the Shy Smile could be the title for her book. And Foley said, I believe you. I believe you because I have no choice but to believe you. I have to, because otherwise that would make you a really good liar and a really bad person. So then later, when Seth Rollins got up in Stephanie's face and said he didn't believe her, that she didn't know anything about it, Foley defended her and he said, I've got your back, Stephanie. Between that and Stephanie's crocodile tears all throughout this entire thing, she's totally turning on Mick Foley and firing him. I don't know when, probably not for a while, but this Foley thing ain't going to last. But it's coming. And she would not be the first woman to turn on Mick Foley and then fire him. If you remember, Melina did it once. She gave him a nut shot, and then Vince McMahon let her fire him in the middle of the ring. This time it'll be a slap instead of a nut shot. It's just a matter of time. This woman is not to be trusted. I like the Kevin Owens championship celebration. He did come out in a suit. Not a tie, but he came out in a suit. But he looked good. You know, he looked good wearing something other than a frickin' t-shirt for a change. The babyface turn for Seth Rollins has been set in motion. It's not quite complete yet. I would not call Seth Rollins a babyface just yet, but he got a great reaction. He stormed down to the ring to confront Foley and Stephanie. He didn't back down from her like a pussy like he has done, and so many people have done so many times before. He actually stood up to her. He told Kevin Owens at one point to shut up. He threatened to burn this place to the ground. And having watched that last hour of the show, I wish he had. They made Rollins versus Owens for the Universal title, the main event, at the Clash of the Champions, as Foley called it. Twice on this show, he called it Clash of the Champions. It's actually Clash of Champions, but you know what? I don't blame him. It should be Clash of the Champions. I don't know why they changed it. Rollins had a match with Chris Jericho. Good match. I thought the two of them were... I can't remember the last time before this I saw a Chris Jericho-Seth Rollins match. That may have been their first match. Rollins won with the pedigree. Bayley pinned Charlotte in a non-title match. This was good. Of course, by the end of the show, I was confused having watched this and realizing that Bayley would not be getting a title match at the next pay-per-view. I think. I'm not even sure anymore. I saw one report online that said WWE.com, their web team was told to scrub all mentions of Sasha and Charlotte at Clash of Champions, so something may have changed in the last few days. Maybe they realized how stupid this all was. Maybe they realized how stupid it was to announce a Sasha-Charlotte match on the same show where Bayley just pinned the champion. Sheamus went up 3-0 on Cesaro in their Best of 7 series. They had a short, just a throwaway match, nothing special. Cesaro continues his transformation into the Yeti, wrapping his entire body up in tape. Of course, Cesaro... He got his first win at a house show that nobody saw. So he got his first win, so now it's 3-1, I think, is what the series is at. And that was it. Those are the only things of note that were either good or decent on this show. That was the only... Actually, I take that back. The main event was good. I enjoyed the main event. But aside from all that I just mentioned, that was about the only thing worth a damn on this entire show. The second hour, I thought, was dull. Much of the third hour, aside from the main event, was absolute dog shit. First of all, let me say this. When I said that I wanted squash matches back on TV, which I had said many times over the years on this show, people would write in, do you think they should bring back jobber matches? And I said, yes, I think they should. Because it got to the point where people were making their debut on TV, and in their first fucking match, they were in there with, you know, like a no-name guy on the roster. Whoever it was, you know, take your pick. And most of the time, they couldn't even get a win in their first match because they didn't want the other guy to lose. So the new guy would either lose or the new guy would win on fucking DQ or countout or something. It was ridiculous. The whole thing about jobber matches was, when I would watch them back in the day on Wrestling Challenge or Superstars, or if you were an NWA fan, you had plenty of those matches on the Saturday Night Show and Worldwide and the Power Hour and all that stuff. It was designed to get someone over, to get their moves over, especially if they were a new person. You just want them to go out there and look like a wrecking machine. So guys would go out there, and so many times on those old, like, syndicated shows that WWE would put on the weekends, some of those jobbers were absolutely murdered by some of these people. They would go out there and beat the shit out of them. But that was the whole point. You know, you wanted your stars to come across like tough guys, and you wanted them to get their big move over. Ooh, what's this guy's finish, you know? So Razor Ramon, week after week, would go out there, and he would be dropping guys left and right with a razor's edge, which is a pretty badass move. Well, imagine if Razor Ramon debuted, and in his first match, they put him in there with Tito Santana. He's probably not beating Tito Santana with the razor's edge, right? And then week two, he's in there with Randy Savage. You've got to establish these guys first, and they just completely abandoned the whole concept and got away from it. So I always thought, you know, it would be kind of cool to bring it back. I don't want to see 2 hours or 3 hours of jobber matches, but I think one here, one there is fine. When they started doing it with Nia Jax and Braun Strowman, I thought it was great. Braun Strowman goes in there, he throws guys around like a rag doll, he looks like a monster. He's not a great wrestler, so for him to go in there and beat some guy and be out of there in 60 seconds, great. Last thing I want to see is Braun Strowman in there for 6 minutes. I'll take 60 seconds of Braun Strowman over 6 minutes. Nia Jax goes in there, they want her to come off as this monster, so she goes in there and, you know, some of these indie female wrestlers get some airtime on Raw, they get pummeled, they get beaten into the ground, and you build up Nia Jax as this unstoppable monster. Great. Well, I'm watching this show, and Bo Dallas, okay? So when I said I wanted squash matches back on TV, I didn't mean I wanted 3 hours of squash matches. It felt like we got 3 hours of squash matches on the show, at least one per hour here on the show. Why is Bo Dallas getting a jobber match? Normally, he's on the other end of it. Bo Dallas, and I love, by the way, after doing nothing with this guy for months and months and months, that it took him getting arrested in an airport bar for causing a disturbance for him to finally win a match on TV. I literally think him getting arrested reminded Vince McMahon that Bo Dallas was still employed by the company. He had forgotten. Like, he legit forgot that he was still under contract, and so suddenly he felt obligated to do something with him. I have no other explanation for this. When was the last time Bo even appeared on Raw, let alone won a match? He had a match on this show. He pummeled the job guy, and he pinned him. So I guess we're supposed to think that Bo Dallas is suddenly getting a push. I don't see what the point of it is. They're never going to do anything with this guy. They have just, you know, he's been established at a certain level. That's where he is. I missed the Bo Dallas, like the funny Bo Dallas from NXT that was, I thought, thoroughly entertaining. Him getting taken away by the Full Sail security. I mean, there was a lot of really great things that Bo Dallas did in NXT to get, you know, that gimmick, the way it got over. Him being completely oblivious to the fact that people thought he was this cheesy asshole, you know. We've had none of that, you know, on WWE TV. At the beginning we did. But they've gotten away from that. And we're supposed to take this guy seriously all of a sudden? He comes out with this giant sign. He walks to the ring with it like, what was that, CJ Parker used to in NXT, where he used to walk out with those giant signs? Who cares? Who gives a shit? And I think when you're sitting through a lot of dull stuff on the show, and then you see Bo Dallas out there, and he's wrestling in a jobber match, it just makes you want to turn the TV off. Like, why am I watching this? This is pointless. This is going to lead to nothing. So then we have the New Day segment. Now, I understand that sometimes stuff is going to hit, sometimes stuff is going to miss. This was one of the worst misfires that I have seen on this show in a long time. This segment sucked. They had Anderson and Gallows out there calling themselves retirement specialists. They'd probably be better off retiring at this point. Okay, I guess after retiring the Dudley Boys, even though the Dudley Boys were out there to retire anyway, so I'm not quite sure. I guess they're taking credit for it. Okay, fine. So now they said they were going to retire the New Day as the tag team champions. Whoever scripted this piece of shit segment, they're the one who should be forced to retire. Anderson and Gallo, and by the way, what a way to kill off two guys who came into the company with some juice. Like, they had some juice to them when they came in. They felt, you know, they felt kind of special. And they had a good thing going with AJ Styles, and they have done nothing with these two since then. They split the brands. If anything, you think, okay, these guys will be more of a focal point, you'll keep them strong. They split them from Styles, and they have turned them into comedy characters. That's what they've turned them into. So they're out there to introduce us to the old day. I miss the old days. They introduce us to the old day, which was just three actors, three really bad actors at that, dressed up as the New Day. I guess they're supposed to be the New Day 50 years from now. One of them had a walker. Another one was in a motorized scooter. This was god-awful. And what's worse is that it went on forever. You would think that at some point there's somebody in the back, Vince or someone, who sees a segment drowning, and they can send a signal to someone at ringside to give the high sign to cut this thing short. Go to a video package. Anything is better than this. No, they let this go on. I think they get a kick out of it. It's like when Titus O'Neil was drowning in that promo all those weeks ago, and he called out Darren Young, and he waited, and nobody came out. I think it was a rib on Titus. They probably get their jollies off on shit like that. They're sitting in the back laughing. So this thing went on forever, and just to get down to the ring took hours. And this entire thing was met by silence from the crowd. And I don't want to hear anybody shitting on this crowd. Where were they here? They were in Kansas City. I don't want to hear anybody shitting on this crowd in Kansas City, because if you got a segment like this, you would die too. So New Day finally comes out. They're going to spare us from the pain, or so I thought. But no, all they did was add to it. They could have ended this right then and there, but instead they dragged it on even longer with more comedy. And when I say comedy, I'm using that word very loosely. Comedy is something that's supposed to make you laugh. Comedy is watching the Raw ratings come in against Monday Night Football for the next few months. That's comedy. This was not comedy. New Day danced. Then the Old Day tried to attack them from behind. Then the New Day beat up their older selves. I think it was Xavier, tried to clothesline one of the Old Day guys over the top rope, but he couldn't even make it over the rope. I thought that was quite the metaphor for this segment. This was pure shit. Now, mind you, this was the top of the hour segment at 10 p.m. By the 10 p.m. hour, I start growing very impatient with the show, if they're not doing something to keep me interested. They gave us that segment, and just as I'm sitting here thinking to myself, I didn't think it was possible to give us something worse than the stuff we've been seeing with Darren Young and Titus O'Neil. They follow that up with Darren Young and Titus O'Neil. Darren Young against Jinder Mahal with Titus on commentary. Titus tried to distract Darren, didn't work. Darren won anyway. Then he attacked Titus, and Titus bailed. At 10:23, let me make sure I got the time right here. 10:23 p.m., Lita, who works for the company, tweeted, "Raw is officially off the rails." Off the rails? That train ran down every single one of us on the tracks and dragged us for about 5 miles before it finally went off the rails. Going off the rails, that's a kind way of putting it. And that's from somebody who actually works for WWE. Then we had the return of Sasha Banks. Sasha was teasing on Twitter all day that she would be on Raw. She had some bad news to share. The implication, of course, being that her injuries are such that she might be retiring. That's what they wanted you to think. Now, I read in this week's Observer, I think it was, that some of the talent were not happy with this promo. People in the company were very unhappy with the promo. Not so much hating on Sasha, but they just felt that the whole idea of it was in poor taste, coming off of Daniel Bryan's actual retirement earlier in the year. That didn't bother me. That didn't bother me at all. What bothered me was the awful verbiage that she was out there spewing. I mean, she came out, and the point was to swerve everybody into thinking she was retiring, and in reality, the bad news that she spoke about was bad news, not for her, it was bad news for Charlotte. Because Sasha was coming back to get her rematch for the women's title. That was the idea. And I didn't buy this for a second. Okay? I didn't buy this for a second. There was a very easy way, by the way, to tell that Sasha Banks was not retiring. She wasn't crying. She tried so hard. As hard as she could, she tried to cry, but she couldn't cry. And anybody who watches Sasha Banks knows that she cries all the time. If they run out of creamer in catering, she cries. And yet here, she couldn't cry. So that, to me, was a dead giveaway right there. If Sasha has to try to cry and she still can't, you know that she doesn't believe a word of what she's saying. But anyway, what the hell does any of this have to do with bra and panties matches and the stupid butterfly belt? That's what she called it. She's talking about all these different things, the women's revolution. She spent 90% of her time talking about all of this stuff that had absolutely nothing to do with her coming out and revealing to Charlotte that she was coming back. And look, I like Sasha Banks. I am a Sasha Banks fan. I liked her in NXT. I still like her now, but I can't be the only one who is getting tired of hearing this all the time. We get it. You guys helped change women's wrestling. That's great. I don't need to hear you talk about it 5,000 times. She's out there talking about the fabulous Moolah and Mae Young and Alundra Blaze and Luna Vachon and Trish and Lita paving the way. She talks about Stephanie McMahon like she's fucking Harriet Tubman using an underground railroad to rescue all the women wrestlers held captive for years by bad booking. You know, forget Harriet Tubman. They should put Stephanie on the front of the $20 bill. That's what I got out of this. Dana Brooke comes out. Sasha put her in the bank statement. Finally, she reveals, I'm coming back at Clash of the Champions to take back my title. Which, again, is questionable. I don't know what's going on there. That may or may not be happening now. But this segment, this was just a bad segment. This was bad. Kevin Owens and Sami Zayn, you know, good as it was a good match. They could not save that last hour. Owens beat him with a powerbomb. Roman Reigns came out. He was serenaded by booze. He, too, was screwed by Triple H the week before, so I'm not quite sure why he waited until now to come out. Chris Jericho walked out. He was going to help out Owens. So all of a sudden, Mick Foley comes out. He makes a match. He says, next Monday on Raw, we're going to have a match between Kevin Owens and Roman Reigns, where if Reigns wins, he will be added to the match, a Clash of Champions between Owens and Rollins. He'll make it a triple threat match. To which Mick Foley, the babyface general manager, basically turned himself heel by making this announcement because he was promptly booed. These people did not want to see Roman Reigns added to that match. And he may well be. You know, Rusev was on Twitter a few days ago, and he mentioned the fact that he was only a few days into his 23-day honeymoon with Lana. So unless he's swerving all of us, that would seem to eliminate the threat of him interfering in the match tomorrow night, which is what I figured was going to happen. So there is a chance that this could be a triple threat on the next pay-per-view. You know, to me, 23 days would seem, that's an awfully long time for a honeymoon. Right? 23 days, that's a long, I mean, that's over 3 weeks. 23 days would also mean that he's missing the next pay-per-view, which is very fishy to me, because the next pay-per-view is called Clash of Champions. And Rusev is the United States champion. So to have a Clash of Champions show without your U.S. champion doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. So if I'm Roman Reigns, I would grow eyes in the back of my head, because I still think Rusev's coming out. I think he's screwing over Roman Reigns. That sets up the U.S. title match for the pay-per-view, and I think they keep it Rollins and Owens at Clash of Champions. At no point on the show did Triple H make an appearance. At no point on the show did anybody address why Triple H did what he did. I assume that explanation will come at some point, but if you were watching the show waiting and hoping for some kind of an explanation, you never got it. This show, I thought the moral of the story is this. They got off to a promising start, and then it just fell off a cliff. I mean, that last hour or so just completely killed the show for me. Just bad, bad television. Bad television headed into the return of Monday Night Football tomorrow night does not sound like such a great idea.
I'm actually not wearing pants, and that's how I watch NXT every single week.
NXT was another unspectacular show this week. I'm not going to lie, you know, NXT was the last thing I watched this week after the Cruiserweight Classic and Lucha Underground. I could have gone without seeing Steve Cutler against Shinsuke Nakamura. TM61 got a win over Tony Nese and Arya Daivari, which is about the most random team I've seen in a long time. They literally just took two guys from the Cruiserweight Classic and put them together as a team. And how Tony Nese, you know, Tony Nese, is he listed? I don't even remember now if he's listed as one of the cruiserweights coming to Raw. If not, he should be. How this guy doesn't get a contract, the way he looks and the way he moves around, I'll never know. Hopefully he is under contract, but if not, they ought to sign this guy. Asuka did a sit-down interview with Tom Phillips and said that she has wiped out the NXT women's division, which is a shoot. You've got Ember Moon, and that's about it. They have gutted the women's division in NXT, so I don't really know where you go next if not Ember Moon. And I think I even said that before. I'm pretty sure I've said that on the show, that I think the next challenger for Asuka will probably be Ember Moon. Speaking of Ember Moon, she beat Leah Vaughn with her jumping, twisting stunner off the top rope. I didn't know anything about this Leah Vaughn, so I looked her up, and she was trained by, among others, Ty Dillinger and Truth Martini, which I thought was interesting. Johnny Gargano checked up on Tommaso Ciampa backstage, who was being evaluated by one of the trainers. Gargano said he just came from William Regal's office, and if Ciampa was cleared, they will have a tag team match on the live Cruiserweight Classic special this Wednesday. And Ciampa did get cleared by the trainer, so they are a go for the show this week. They didn't say who it would be against. But can you feel it? Can you feel it? The turn. The turn is a-coming. Maybe not this week. Maybe in November at the next TakeOver special, but it's coming. Austin Aries beat Andrade Cien Almas with the last chancery for the submission win. Almas is no longer sporting the top hat and suspenders. He wore a t-shirt instead, which is still 1,000 times better than what he was wearing before. Nakamura pinned Ron Perlman in the main event with the Kinshasa. Samoa Joe was on commentary. He was being awfully deferential to the champion, almost unnervingly so. You could tell he was fuming mad that Nakamura had his title, but you know, he kept his cool throughout, and when the match was over, he simply threw down his headset and he walked to the back. So that was it. A very, very basic show. And when you have a very, very basic show up against two other shows in the same night, like the Cruiserweight Classic and Lucha Underground, you know, it's just kind of there. I don't really have a whole lot of positive to say about these NXT shows the last few weeks. Hopefully they pick up the pace here. Cruiserweight Classic was awesome. We're winding down here. Two quarterfinal matches this week. We had Zack Sabre Jr. against Noam Dar. Really good stuff. You know, Noam Dar finally had a match that I liked. This was all about working different body parts. Dar worked over Sabre's knee. Sabre worked over Dar's elbow. Sabre got the win with a double armbar using only his legs to wrench back on the shoulders. And, well, Dar had also been working on his arm, so it made sense that Sabre couldn't use his arm, so he used his legs. And it kind of looked like the old Rings of Saturn move, but this looked even more brutal, just the way he wrenched back on the shoulders with his legs. Dar tapped out, so Sabre advances to the semifinals. Dar is coming to the Cruiserweight division on Raw. Sabre is not, by the way. Rich Swann and TJ Perkins was the other match. Kota Ibushi is my pick to win the whole thing, but I said if Ibushi is not signed, I doubt he's winning this thing, and so Rich Swann would have been my backup choice. Well, so much for my backup choice. He got bounced right out of the tournament by TJP. I know Swann is really well-liked at Full Sail, but I was surprised by how much hate there was for TJ Perkins. I mean, they were booing this guy a lot. Some showmanship early on. Perkins did some dabbing. Is that what they call it? I think they call it dabbing. I'm not sure when that became a thing, but I'm still waiting for somebody to teach me how to Dougie. I don't know. Is that still a thing? Do people still talk about that? I don't know. I hope so, because I never learned. So then Swann dabbed, and that made TJP really upset. And finally, we got down to wrestling. Swann did a moonsault off the apron onto the floor. He landed on his feet. He sold it. He tweaked his knee on the way down. So he sold that damn knee for the rest of the match. And Perkins ended up winning with a knee bar, which I think that's Noam Dar's move as well. We've got two guys now with knee bars for well, I guess we have one now since the other guy got eliminated. But as soon as Rich Swann tapped, Perkins checked on him to make sure his friend was okay, the nice guy that he is. He better not be nice this week because he's facing Kota Ibushi in the semifinals, so he better fucking nut up or shut up here because I don't think things are going to go too well for TJP. We got a live 2-hour special this Wednesday with two semifinal matches, Ibushi against TJP and Zack Sabre Jr. against Gran Metalik. And the winners will advance later that night to the final match to crown a winner. And I cannot see Ibushi not at least being in the finals. I mean, I get it if he doesn't win the whole thing, even though he's the best guy in the tournament, he should win. But I see it as Ibushi against Metalik in the finals. And I'm going to stick with Ibushi. But, you know, if they don't have him locked down to a contract, it's hard to see them giving him... It's hard to see them giving him the trophy as a going-away present, right, to go back to Japan. I just don't see that. So I hope he wins, because it's a sign that he's in. I'd like to see more of him. I'd like to see him on Raw. But if not, I think Metalik would be the winner, I think. TNA. Haven't talked much TNA recently, but I was a big fan of Final Deletion 1, and I heard they were doing Final Deletion 2. This time they called it Delete or Decay. A lot has changed since the first Final Deletion. Matt Hardy is now a babyface. And Brother Nero is now with him. They are now together instead of being adversaries. And they have been feuding with Decay, which is a faction that's made up of Abyss, Crazy Steve, and Rosemary, I believe her name is. So I watched Delete or Decay. Fun stuff. I think I enjoyed the first one more. So if I had to rank them, I would put that one first. But... you know, maybe it was more for the novelty of it, you know, I don't know. But I enjoyed this too. I mean, the thing about it was the first one I thought was funnier. There were a lot more, like, laugh-out-loud moments I had watching that first one than I did this one. But this was also funny, but it was filmed more like a horror movie. Not so much for comedy. And so it was so over the top, but you had to also kind of take it seriously because they were advancing this storyline. This was an actual feud that's going on TV between these two factions. Now, I happen to like horror movies, as many of you know. Maybe that's why I enjoyed it so much. And then you have horror movies that I don't like so much, like Raw on most weeks. So here we had Broken Matt and Brother Nero at the zoo playing with giraffes and kangaroos. And Jeff Hardy sparred with a kangaroo. Yes, that actually happened. That isn't even the weirdest thing that he's ever done. What made this even funnier is that if you pay attention during the kangaroo segment when Matt begins to spar with the kangaroo, you can see Jeff in the background just totally corpsing. He's trying to hold it together. He can't. He goes off screen. I don't blame him. I don't know how any of these guys could film any of this stuff and not just bust out laughing. Matt also assigned names to the different animals. So the giraffe was named George Washington and the kangaroo was Smokin' Joe Frazier. And then they went to the monkey cage, and Matt said he had the ability to communicate with spot monkeys, two of whom he called Nick and Matt, the Bucks of Youth. That was probably the best part of this entire thing. And finally, Matt was able to speak with a tiger named Genghis Khan, who tipped him off that the Decay were on their way to the Hardy compound. Copious amounts of narcotics, no doubt, were consumed before all of this was filmed. They may have drugged the animals, too, for all we know. The Decay stuff was something straight out of a Rob Zombie film, but far less fucked up, except for the implied rape of the guy whose pickup truck they stole. All we saw was the driver laying face down on the road with his pants around his ankles after they drove off, or as we say here in New York, a Friday night. So the Decay arrives at the Hardy home, and immediately they get blasted by Roman Reigns. Matt sends, Roman Candles. Matt sends Rebby back inside the house to protect King Maxwell. And by the way, what the hell is Maxwell going to think when he gets older and he watches all this stuff back? You know? I guess if I'm Maxwell, I'm probably thinking, wow, my parents are the coolest parents in the world. But I don't know. That's got to be weird. Eventually, he's going to watch all of this stuff. So the Decay took refuge behind Skarsgård, the dilapidated boat. Jeff Hardy drop-kicked the boat, which overturned and seemingly drowned Abyss in the lake. There was a lake. And we then had the return of Joseph Park, who at one time was my favorite character in all of wrestling. Hard to believe. So Joseph Park, he's in his suit and tie and everything. He even put his teeth in. He goes over to Senor Benjamin, who, of course, for those of you who don't know, is Matt Hardy's gardener, played by Rebby Sky's father. Try to keep up here. So he goes over to Senor Benjamin, and he's very friendly, and he wants to give him a big hug, and he got tased for his troubles and then had his body dumped in a shallow grave. If Vince McMahon had his way, he would love to do that to all lawyers, I'm sure. Vince hates lawyers. Except his own, of course. So we also had a pool fight scene with Brother Nero and Crazy Steve, who had seemingly been drowned, but then we had what was a clear homage to the original Friday the 13th with Steve popping up out of the water and pulling Jeff Hardy back into the water. I like that. Somewhere in here, Abyss grabbed Janice, who is not a person. Janice is a board with nails in it. It is not Dixie Carter's mother, although it is named after Dixie Carter's mother. He tried to kill Matt with Janice, but Brother Nero sacrificed himself for Broken Matt and took a shot to the gut. It is unknown if he is dead or dying after that. So meanwhile, Rosemary, the one who I presume raped the dude back on the road. Actually, I shouldn't presume anything. I've seen Deliverance. Either way, wouldn't be the first time someone got fucked by TNA. Rosemary emerged from the house with King Maxwell. She was trying to kidnap him until Vanguard 1, the drone, came to the rescue. Rosemary spit some kind of mist at Vanguard 1, and it malfunctioned and shut itself off. And Matt then showed up, and Rosemary spit mist at Matt. But Matt swallowed the mist and spat it right back into her face. I've seen porn scenes like this before. Don't judge me. The mist, I guess the mist must have burned her face because Rosemary left the baby and she ran off screaming. Maxwell was saved. Senor Benjamin, unfortunately, he was not so lucky. He was loaded up into the back of the pickup truck and driven off by the decay. So, to be continued. This feud is far from over. I assume this is all going to culminate in an actual wrestling match at Bound for Glory next month. You know, that almost seems anticlimactic to me. Like, how do you climax this feud and everything we saw here in this segment with a wrestling match? Like, I don't want to see a wrestling match. I want to see how they can top what they did here. Like, the proper way for this match to end is to have the Hardys travel to the Decay's compound. If they even have one. Their compound is probably a cardboard box under a bridge somewhere. But they need to, like, travel to them and finish this with, like, one big final battle. The Impact Zone hardly seems like the proper place for this feud to end. Lucha Underground Season 3 is on the air. Lucha Underground is back. Very happy. And not a moment too soon after some of that garbage we saw on Monday. It was quite fitting that I think this would be the week that this show would be back on the air. Last we left things, Dario Cueto was being taken to jail in the back of a paddy wagon. And we opened here with him being released and a prison guard saying that he must be friends with people in high places. And when he goes to collect his items, we see the Honky Tonk Man playing the cop who gives him back his watch and his money clip and his giant key. I'm hoping that isn't the last of him that we see. He actually looked... That looked like the perfect role for him. Just, I don't know what it was about it, but the Honky Tonk Man is this old, like, I don't know, maybe jaded prison cop or prison guard or whatever. Seems like a very appropriate role for him, but hopefully it's not the last that we'll see of him. So there's a stretch limo that picks up Dario outside the jail, and inside is Lorenzo Lamas and the higher power that he spoke of last season, whoever this boss guy is. All we see of him is part of his arm. He looks and sounds exactly like Dr. Claw from Inspector Gadget. And the only thing missing was the cat. That was it. So in the temple, and maybe Inspector Gadget is going to end up in Lucha Underground this season. Maybe. In the temple, Dario announced a Rey Mysterio versus Pentagon Dark main event. He also created a new gimmick called Dario's Dial of Doom. His version of Raw Roulette, I guess. Since Matanz has beaten everybody of any note, he's got some new names that he put on the wheel, and whoever it lands on will get a Lucha Underground Championship match against his brother Matanza right now. And so the wheel lands on Son of Havoc. So Son of Havoc gets an immediate title shot, which makes all the sense in the world, given the way that Season 2 ended, with Dario screwing Son of Havoc out of a Lucha Underground title match at Ultima Lucha 3 later this season, which Son of Havoc, it looked like he had won, and you know he would have gotten himself a championship match at the end of this season, but he got screwed out of it. But hey, Dario didn't seem to mind at all here that Son of Havoc was getting a shot anyway. Matanza beat him. I like this match a lot. I thought Son of Havoc looked tremendous. Not enough to win. Matanza won with his Wrath of the Gods suplex. But, you know, and Matanza's no slouch either. I mean, he's a fairly big guy. He's not tall, but he's a big guy, and he's out there doing standing moonsault headbutts. So this was a fun match. Back in Dario's office, Johnny Mundo, PJ Black, Jack Evans, and Taya walk in, and Mundo harasses him over not getting a Lucha Underground title match. And Dario points out that, well, your name was on the wheel, but you just didn't get picked. And he also points out that it was Johnny Mundo who lost his team, the Trios, titles at Ultima Lucha. And Mundo blamed his loss on Angelico, and then they cut to a flashback sequence that we never saw last season. I presume after Angelico screwed them out of the titles, all four of them attacked him outside the temple. They ganged up on him. And Mundo broke Angelico's leg in the door of his car. I think it was the door. Was it the door of his car or maybe the trunk lid? Whatever it was, they fucked him up pretty bad. So I imagine that'll be the storyline excuse for Angelico being gone. Because if you remember, he got injured last season. I think it was his elbow. I think he got a dislocated elbow in like an indie match somewhere. Or was it, you know, I can't even remember if it was at the tapings. It might have been at the Lucha Underground tapings. Whatever it was, he got hurt. I don't know why he was out that first time, because Angelico was out for a long time last season. Maybe it was another injury. I don't think that was the elbow injury. So he's going to be out again, and maybe this was the storyline excuse for it, because he had surgery. I know he was going to be out for a while. So anyway, they kind of flash back here to the room, and everyone's laughing, and Dario just stops and says, "You're still not getting a title shot." And Johnny Mundo said he'll face Sexy Star instead for her Gift of the Gods title, but Dario put Taya in the match instead. Ivelisse is in the ring. She calls out Katrina for costing her two matches now at Ultima Lucha. She wants her first win at Ultima Lucha to be against Katrina. Katrina shows up, calls her a bitch, and they made the match official for Ultima Lucha 3, which, unless they're doing two Ultima Luchas this season, seems very far away. This is a 40-episode season, which means it won't end until next June. So it may be a while before we get to see that match. That'll be Katrina's very first match in Lucha Underground. When I interviewed her many months ago, she said she wanted to get in the ring at some point. I said, "Do you have the itch? Do you want to actually wrestle instead of just doing all these cameos?" And she said, "Yeah." So she's finally getting her chance. Sexy Star against Taya for the Gift of the Gods title. Taya seemed to be doing quite well. She was holding her own in there when Mundo and Black and Jack Evans came out to distract the referee. And Johnny Mundo was holding Sexy Star. Taya went for a baseball slide or a baseball drop kick. Sexy moved, and she hit Mundo with it instead by accident, and then she got rolled up for the pin. So a distraction roll-up finish here on this show. And they all ganged up on Sexy after the match until Phoenix, Drago, and Aerostar, the new Trios champions, ran out to make the save. I don't know. You know, Taya was doing just fine by herself without those guys, and they screwed it all up for her. So if I were her, I'd be a little pissed off about that. And maybe she will be next week. I guess we'll see. I trust Lucha Underground. I have way more trust in the writers here on this show than I do any other wrestling show, so I trust that when I say things like that, more often than not, they do follow up on it, so I trust they will here as well. Marty the Moth interrupted Dario in his office. A lot of interruptions in Dario's office. You ought to lock the door. Try doing that. So Marty interrupted him, and Dario had to end his phone call. He was on his red bat phone. He told Marty that Killshot wanted his dog tags back, and so next week they're going to be in a Weapons of Mass Destruction match where anything goes. Rey Mysterio against Pentagon Dark in the main event. Good match. Pentagon at one point got in Vampiro's face at ringside to the point where Vampiro had to excuse himself from commentary and went to the back, which left us with Matt Stryker by himself. What a heel that Vampiro is. 619 by Mysterio into a Canadian destroyer, or a Mexican destroyer in this case, off the middle rope. He gets the win over Pentagon Dark. Pentagon Dark still searching for his very first win. This is his second straight loss now since moving to the dark side. He attacked Rey after the match. He went to go break his arm, but Dragon Azteca Jr. made the save. And the show ends with a backstage vignette. It ended with a shot of Prince Puma backstage pondering his future in NXT. I mean, pondering his loss to Rey Mysterio at Ultima Lucha. Vampiro shows up. He tells him what you need to do is get revenge on Mil Muertes because you have been in a downward spiral. You have not been the same since Muertes beat you. And I'm pretty sure, I think this is going to be his last season. I think he has already made the decision to not re-sign with Lucha Underground, Ricochet, and he'll be in WWE whenever he's legally allowed to be. I have no doubt about that in my mind. They had to know there would be a good possibility going into this season, so if that's the case, I guess we'll see if they chose to write him off in the storylines, if he's going to get killed or something this season. I guess we'll find out as the season progresses. But I really like this episode. A couple of good matches, a little cameo from the Honky Tonk Man, and Dario Cueto remains my favorite character in all of wrestling. This, I mean, he's so damn good. He's just so damn good that he is still my absolute favorite. So let's get to your mailbag questions. If you have questions, you can email me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. Joseph from New Jersey, what are your best and worst Backlash pay-per-views? Honestly, Joseph, I can't remember most of them. I really like the Austin Rock match from the first one in 99. People think I'm crazy for liking that match more than their WrestleMania 17 match, but I make no apologies for it. I liked it more. You know, deal with it. I'd have to go with Backlash 2000. That's the one I remember the most. Just offhand, I know it had a really good light heavyweight title match with Dean Malenko and Scotty Too Hotty. A really good, I think, intercontinental title match with Jericho and Benoit. Great main event with Rock and Triple H, the match that should have happened at WrestleMania. Steve Austin comes in. Long, sustained 5-minute pop for this whole thing. This was Austin's first appearance since neck surgery. He mowed everybody down with a chair. That would be my favorite Backlash card. I mean, the worst one, I couldn't tell you because I can't remember all of them. Especially the later ones in like 07, 08, 09. They all kind of blend together. I guess maybe whichever one had McMahon and Shane against God and Shawn Michaels. That was fucking dumb. But Backlash 2000, to me, would easily be the best. Chris from Ajax, Ontario, Canada. I never heard of that before. Ajax, Ontario, Canada. With NXT TakeOver coming to Toronto Survivor Series weekend, what do you think of a Bobby Roode versus Ty Dillinger match? Two Canadian boys going at it, as over as both of them are. And what do you think of Finn Balor if he can return to the ring in time to be number 30 in the Royal Rumble? Hey, you know, if Balor can make it, I think it'd be great. He should get a title shot as soon as he comes back anyway. So, you know, wins the Rumble, goes on to WrestleMania. I'm fine with that. But I think the Rumble is being very generous. I don't know that he'll be back by then. For TakeOver in Toronto, I don't think Bobby Roode should be wrestling Ty Dillinger at all. I think he should be wrestling Nakamura for the NXT Championship. There's a long time between now and then. They could do the Joe rematch, you know, which obviously they're building to a rematch with Samoa Joe. They could do that next month once he heals up from his injuries. You know, they could do it on NXT television in October, and then maybe at that point they could move Joe to the main roster and then save the Bobby Roode match for Canada in November. I mean, that's how I would do it. Steve from, is it Henner, England? I hope I'm pronouncing that right. Henner, England? Creative really needs to help Apollo Crews. The smile and the way he presents himself reminds me so much of Rocky Maivia in 1997. The fans will soon turn on him if this continues. It's a shame because his in-ring work is spectacular. The smile has to go. I can't take him seriously. He's worked so hard, and I hope he gets over naturally with the fans and not shoved down our throats. I don't think enough baby faces are getting over naturally these days. Crews is great. He just needs to have a little fine-tuning. What say you? Look, I've been talking about his excessive smiling since he first debuted in NXT. I haven't been talking about this in just the last few weeks like everybody else. From day fucking one, I was talking about, man, this guy smiles a lot. And it's okay to smile, but you get to a point where it's almost creepy how much he smiles. And I'm telling you, people start to resent you for it. People, it's like, fans innately don't want you to be happy, right? It's like, I don't know, maybe there's some underlying thing going on here where the fans just want you to go out there and be fucking miserable and just have a scowl on your face and go around and just kick ass, right? And I thought Daniel Bryan and Dolph Ziggler actually did a good job on Talking Smack last week of trying to explain why he smiles so much. They actually tried to explain it. They talked about his upbringing and how rough it was, or how it wasn't easy. Not like he got smacked around by his mother or something, but you know, it's just how happy he is to have made it this far. they at least made an attempt to explain why, which is what they should be doing on the main shows and not on frickin' Talking Smack, or have Cruz go on TV in a promo and explain it himself. But still, he has to tone it down. I agree. He has to tone it down. His physical skills are unreal. I mean, unreal what this guy can do for a guy his size. But the best I could say about his persona is he's a nice guy. He's a nice guy who smiles a lot. That is death. A nice guy who smiles a lot is death. They get eaten alive. I don't want him to be a nice guy. I want him to kick ass. I mean, this guy can be a big-time player. He just needs to tweak things, that's all. Sergio from San Antonio. Why is WWE turning Titus O'Neil heel again when the fans clearly like him more as a babyface and more than Darren Young? I think the fans would prefer to see Titus chase them as heels and eventually get his revenge on both Darren and Bob back. I disagree. I don't think anybody cares one iota about this feud. And the crowd reactions, I mean, there you go. You don't need me to tell you that. Look at the crowd reactions. Week in and week out. You can't just blame it on one bad crowd and one bad city. Week after week, nobody gives a shit. Nobody cares. It doesn't matter who the heel is and who the babyface is. It's not working. People don't care. Michelle from Saudi Arabia. I've been listening since episode 157. What information do you have on the infamous cage match between Lex Luger and Bruiser Brody, where Brody would not sell anything during their match? Was he just trying to protect his character, or was there more to it? Yeah, that's an infamous story in the videos online. They had a cage match. It was in, I don't remember what year it was. It was in the 80s, obviously. And it was in the Florida territory. So this would have been Luger. I know Luger had already signed a deal. He was leaving. He was going to work for Jim Crockett Promotions. So whatever year Luger went to the NWA, that would have been the year that this match took place. Could have been 88, maybe. 88 or 89. Actually, I guess it would have had to be 87 or 88 because Brody got killed. He got murdered in 88, so he was definitely not around in 89. So Luger had already signed a deal, I think, to go to Jim Crockett Promotions. He had one foot out the door. And you'll hear different versions of this story. I don't know that there's one singular confirmed version of exactly what happened. I think conventional wisdom and the story that people have believed and settled on most is that Luger was being difficult, or Luger didn't want to lose. He had a big head, a big chip on his shoulder, which is not hard to believe. And Brody was not a guy to be trifled with. I mean, Brody, he was difficult enough as it is. I mean, he never got a run in WWE. He never got a big run in WCW or NWA, whatever, because he was notoriously difficult to work with, and he was not necessarily the most trustworthy person. He was a wild card. You never knew what he was going to do or if he was going to cooperate, and that's just how he was. That was the reputation that he had built up for himself. And so some versions of the story are that, well, he was just being difficult, and, you know, he was trying to teach Luger a lesson. And I think the prevailing story is that even though Luger will say otherwise, and Luger's talked about this, and if you watch video of the match seems to be going fine for the first few minutes, and then like halfway in, Brody just, he becomes the Undertaker. He just stops selling. So Luger's throwing punch after punch after punch, and Brody's just standing there staring at him. He's not selling it, he's not bumping, he's not retaliating, he's just standing there. And it's funny, because at one point Luger looks over at the referee with this look like, what the fuck am I supposed to do here? Like, what's going on? Like, he didn't know. And all of a sudden Brody starts to fight back, but it looks like a shoot. It looks like he's shooting on Luger. He takes him down, and Luger just... I think the referee calls for a DQ just to end it. Luger wants no part of this. You've never seen somebody climb out of a steel cage as quickly as you saw Lex Luger climb out of a cage here. Like, I believe he was legit terrified of Bruiser Brody, and who wouldn't be? I would be terrified of Bruiser. I wouldn't even have the balls to step in a cage with this guy, even in a work pro wrestling match. So Luger hightails it. He wasn't even waiting for them to unchain the cage door. He climbs out, he leaves, he goes to the back. The belief, I think, if I'm remembering correctly, as the story goes, Luger went to the back, he got his shit, and he left. He was out of there, never to return. Luger, I remember him in like a shoot talking about this, and he was like, nah, it was fine. Like, I went over to Brody backstage, and I asked him, oh, you know, did I do anything wrong? What did I do wrong? And he said Brody was like, no, it wasn't you. It was the promoter or something, or like I work as a babyface and you were a babyface, and so the finish just wasn't going to work. Like none of it actually makes sense when you hear Luger talk about that. I tend to believe that Luger was probably scared shitless, wanted no part of Brody when Brody got to the back, so he left and he hightailed it. That's what I think happened. I think Luger probably either didn't want to do the job or he was being difficult in some way. Brody wasn't having any of his shit, and that's why he stopped selling for him and he started shooting on him at the end of the match. Steven from Whittier, California, what do you think could have been done to make the NWO work properly in WWE? Would you have booked Hall or Hogan over Rock or Austin at WrestleMania 18? Would you have added other members besides Shawn Michaels? What would you have done? See, here's the thing. I got this question, and I get questions about that a lot. Like, how would you have handled the invasion or the NWO? Why did it fail? All this stuff. And I'm sure people are just tired of hearing me talk about the invasion. But since this guy asked, I was thinking about this. The thing with the NWO is it had already run its course. The NWO was a thing in 1996, all the way through 99, maybe even 2000, okay? You had 3 or 4 years of the NWO and all the NWO splinter factions. It ran its course. WCW beat it into the ground. So it was never going to be what it was before. Now, could they have made it work? Could they still have made it work on some level? Absolutely. Could they have made some money with it? You bet. The only way to do it, or the best way to do it, I think, would have been... And this is different from my idea of how I would have done the invasion, but if we're talking specifically about how to get the NWO some juice and how to get the NWO thing to work, I would have kept it just to the original members. You have Hogan, Hall, and Nash. They come in, but you have Bischoff come in with them. You don't have this thing where Vince McMahon, the owner of the company, I'm going to bring in the NWO. And I know the whole thing was I'm going to poison my company. I want to see my company fail. But you had Vince McMahon bring in the NWO. It's like they're just sitting at home, you know, on the porch, drinking a beer, hanging out, and they get a call one day from Vince, hey, I want you to come in. Okay. Like, the NWO, when they first materialized, it was this invading force that was just taking over the entire company and wreaking havoc. So, if you want to maintain that, if you want to try to replicate that, the best way to do it would be to have not Vince have anything to do with bringing them in, but... You know, have Bischoff come in. Now, Bischoff ended up coming into the company months later anyway. So if they would have just made that deal a little bit earlier, you could have had a Bischoff-led NWO invasion. Have Bischoff be the one to lead an invasion of Vince's company. As far as new members, you have him start picking off guys from Vince's own roster, current WWE guys, to join with him. So all of a sudden, you've got the original members. They're the ones who should initially come in and quote-unquote invade. But Eric makes an attempt to pick off people from Vince's own roster. He's using Vince's own guys against him. And it's great because if they really wanted to give those other WCW guys a chance at getting over in front of a WWE audience, and some of them did. I mean, I'm not saying that every WCW guy that came over was booed. And you know, some of them it worked out just fine, and some of them it didn't. But the WWE audience still saw WCW... as the bad guys. They were conditioned to look at them as the bad guys. That's just how it was. And if they really wanted to try to get those WCW guys over with their own fans, you have those guys come to the rescue and join with Austin, join with Rock, join with Undertaker, the top WWE guys, to fend off Bischoff and the NWO, because the story's already built in. These guys have already fought against the NWO. They know what the NWO is all about. They've been in the ring. They've been in the wars with them before. So they come in, you know, Goldberg comes in to stand with Austin and Rock and those guys to fight off the NWO. You've got Sting coming in to stand side by side with Undertaker to help fight off the NWO. It's putting another spin on the invasion if you wanted to make it NWO versus WWE. And not just WCW against WWE, with Bischoff leading all the WCW guys. All the WCW guys are the heels. Like, instead of doing it that way, you do it a different way. It's a different twist on doing things. And I think if you wanted to have Bischoff just lead all the WCW guys in, which is kind of what I was pitching as an alternative to what they did with the invasion, I think that's fine if you want an us-against-them deal. Right, that's the whole alternate idea that I had pitched. But if it's specifically the NWO that you want to keep strong and you want to make them a threat, that's the way I would have done it. So now you have the WWE heroes standing with the WCW heroes, and they're all getting cheered, and they're all over, they're all super over, and once the NWO has been beaten, once the NWO has been defeated, the threat has been neutralized, you can integrate them into the company naturally. Like, once the NWO is vanquished, Sting's in the company now, and Goldberg's in the company now, and you could build to other big matches like Goldberg against Austin, Sting against Undertaker. You could just kind of go from there. That's what I would have done with the NWO. Andrew, buy or sell? Ready to Rumble or No Holds Barred? Oh, No Holds Barred. Buy on No Holds Barred. It's not even a question. Daryl from Hartford, Connecticut. We'll do one more here. Buy or sell? This is a tough one. That's why I pulled it. Buy or sell on the better in-ring talent, Shawn Michaels or AJ Styles? That is a really... You're talking specifically in-ring talent? That is a difficult question. If we're talking overall performer, I'm buying Shawn Michaels. I'm selling AJ Styles. Shawn Michaels is still at or near the top of the list, best of all time. It's tough because AJ's not done. I mean, AJ's almost 40, but he could have another 5-10 years if he keeps himself healthy. His career is not over. In fact, he's doing some of the best work of his career right now. For all the great matches he's had, for all the great matches in TNA, he's doing some of the best work of his career now. So it's almost as though, like, Shawn Michaels had that second career when he came back from the back surgery, and in a lot of ways he did the best work of his career the second half, for the 8 years or whatever it lasted. I don't know if AJ's going to be around for 8 years, but he's kind of in the second half or the last leg or whatever you want to call it of the next phase of his career. He's only just begun. So who knows how many more years, how many more great matches. He may end up as this great babyface. Right now, I'm digging what he's doing as a heel. I still, you know, when I compare Shawn Michaels' heel work, especially like in 97 and on the microphone and all that, compared with AJ, I'm giving the edge to Shawn. He's not in Shawn territory just yet. I'm digging the goofy heel stuff he's doing now. Shawn was not being the goofy heel. He was being goofy, but he wasn't, you know, meant to be portrayed that way. He was just being himself. So I think AJ has a ways to go. If we're talking just in-ring work, it's hard. I mean, it really is hard to put one over the other here, because I look at the body of work that AJ Styles has had. All the great matches and that famous triple threat at, what was it, Unbreakable in TNA, which some people still think is the greatest match in TNA history. The matches he had with guys like Daniels and Joe and Kurt Angle. I look at the stuff he did in New Japan. So here's a guy who spent most of his career in TNA, had matches with all those guys and the same guys over and over again, right? He leaves. So now you don't know what to expect, because AJ Styles has spent most of his career, a little bit in Ring of Honor, but he spent most of his career in one company. He's now leaving. He's in uncharted waters here. He goes to Japan. He goes to another country, another culture. He goes to New Japan. He tears it up. Tears it up. The matches with Okada, the match with Nakamura. I mean, this guy went to New Japan and was having match of the year after match of the year. And he was portrayed as a serious heel champion. He was not there to be goofy. He was not there to wear Ric Flair's robe and be the second coming of Ric Flair. He was not there, you know, with Claire Lynch or doing any of that goofy bullshit. He went over there. He was the heel champion, leader of the Bullet Club, and he absolutely tore it up in New Japan. Now he comes to WWE, another new company. So now he's going to a completely new place again. And he has been tearing it up. I mean, just, you know, match after match, week after week, whether it was as a babyface early on, as a heel with the club, the matches with Roman Reigns, the match he had with all the matches he had with John Cena. The SummerSlam match was fantastic. And hopefully by the time you listen to this, he is now the champion coming out of Backlash. And if he's not, he will be soon, because how can he not be? I don't care who has the title, he is the star of that SmackDown brand. He's basically going to be the one carrying that brand on his shoulders, as I see it, until somebody else comes along, because I don't know that Ambrose is that guy. Styles is. He's had a pretty amazing career when you look at him going from one place to the next, and the one constant is he always delivers. And he can do things in the ring that Shawn Michaels never did. Now, Shawn Michaels might have been better in certain facets. I mean, I can't even say Shawn was a better storyteller. He was better with psychology and selling hold. I don't know. AJ Styles is pretty freaking good at that, too. So I can't even sit here and tell you that Shawn Michaels is better at that than he is. They're kind of on the same level. As an in-ring performer, I still, you know, it's tough. It really is tough. I probably still give the edge to Shawn Michaels, but not by much. And I think when AJ is done, if he has another 5-10 years in his career, by the time all is said and done, he goes into the Hall of Fame and all that, he may well be better than Shawn. He may well have had the better career than Shawn Michaels, at least when it comes to like in-ring matches. I don't know that when people look back on the greatest of all time, they're going to put AJ above Shawn. I wouldn't. But I can't answer that question right now. I mean, talk to me in 10 years. I might have a completely different perspective on things. But right now, I've got to buy on Shawn. I'm going to sell on AJ. Put an asterisk next to it because that could change. You know, that could change as time goes on. I will say this though again, I just think it's a lot more impressive what AJ has been able to do going from one company and one country to the next, all these different places that he went to, and being able to turn out the kind of matches that he has. That's very impressive. I mean, Shawn spent his entire career, well, I mean, once he came over to WWE, he never left. He never went to WCW, he never went to TNA. He spent the lion's share of his career working for one person in one company, working with a lot of the same people over and over and over again. And that's fine, and his body of work speaks for itself, but I do think that AJ has been more impressive in that way. But I can't call him the better performer than Shawn. He's not there yet. I still got to go with Shawn. All right, so with that out of the way, it's time for us to reveal number 8 on the list of the top 9 greatest promos and interviews in WWE history. This is my personal list. I have ranked what, in my opinion, are the 9 best promos or interviews in specifically in WWE history. And last week, we kicked things off with number 9, Vince McMahon's Life Sucks and Then You Die promo from SmackDown in 2000. This week, we are fast-forwarding 13 years to number 8 in the countdown to one of the greatest hoaxes in WWE history, something I reviewed in full on Sound Off episode 280. One of the more unlikely people to appear in a countdown of the greatest promos of all time, especially when you consider all the years this guy spent working for the company before finally getting his big break. He debuted for them in 1996, one of the longest tenured guys on that roster, and he didn't win his first world title until 2011. And it was on the June 17, 2013 edition of Monday Night Raw that Mark Henry teased that he would be announcing his retirement on the show. And in fact, I can remember that day. I remember he was tweeting up a storm. He was tweeting everybody, hey, you should watch Raw. He tweeted the coach at ESPN, tune into Raw tonight, I'm going to be announcing my retirement. And it was believable enough to think that this would be it for him because he had been off TV with some injuries for a while. It seemed like most of his career was plagued by injuries. He just turned 42, I believe. He'd been with the company, like I said, forever. It seemed like it was the right time for him to call it a day. So he got that Hall of Pain run, which was the best run of his career. He won the World Heavyweight title. It felt like it was going to be it for him. John Cena had just beaten Ryback the night before to retain the WWE title in a 3 Stages of Hell match, otherwise known today as 3 Hours of Raw. He was in the ring, Mark Henry's music hit. And he walked out wearing what has become his infamous salmon-colored jacket. Whenever they get that physical Hall of Fame up and running, they better have that salmon jacket in a display case because that's where it belongs. I mean, they have Archie Bunker's chair sitting in the Smithsonian. WWE can get Mark Henry's salmon jacket into their Hall of Fame. Cena goes to leave. Henry tells him, John, no, you stay because I want you to hear this too. And what sold this for me was that constantly throughout this segment, the crowd would erupt into chants of thank you, Henry, one more match, sexual chocolate, which was funny. But Henry would stop and he would wipe away tears. Like, he was crying throughout this entire thing. And in my mind, I'm thinking, like, Mark Henry can't possibly be this good of an actor. This has to be real. That's what I'm thinking as I'm watching this. He said he was a seasoned vet when Cena came into the company in 2002, and he turned to Cena. Cena was standing on the apron. And he turned to Cena and said, "You're doing an awesome job, and at the rate you're going, you may be the greatest WWE champion of all time," which was maybe the only time in this segment that Henry was booed. I guess he got booed when he actually formally announced his retirement, but one of the few times he got booed was complimenting John Cena and calling him the greatest of all time. He said if he had any regrets about his career, it's been that he's been the world heavyweight champion, he's been an ECW champion, he's been the strongest man in the world. He hasn't had the success that John Cena has had, but he thinks he did pretty well for himself. And it all just came across as very heartfelt and very genuine. Not like something was scripted for him to say, like, okay, he's out there memorizing lines or reciting lines in a promo or something like that. He says, "I'm out there to formally announce my retirement from the active roster." And at this point, Cena gets in the ring, he hands him the WWE title to pose with, and Henry gives it back to him and says, "This is something you need to earn." And the key here is he comes across as totally sincere, totally humble. He says, "I've traveled the world twice, three times, quadruple times over. Don't cry for me, Argentina. I'm doing enough crying for everybody. Today, I stand before you a proud man. And, I've been on the road close to 200 nights a year." And then he played the family card, which just put the whole thing over the top for me. Because, again, I bought this whole thing hook, line, and sinker when it happened. He talks about his family. He got you with the family card here. He played the family card. He says his wife will get to see more of him now than she probably wants to. He talked about his son. He talked about him being a fanatical wrestling fan. He mentioned his daughter who cries when he leaves home. That right there was the money line. And he goes, "Baby, I'm coming home." And everybody gives him a standing ovation. Crowd bought into this. I bought into this. Cena gets in the ring, he raises Henry's arm, he goes in to hug him, and that's when Henry lowers the boom, picks him up, drops him with the world's strongest slam. And, sometimes you don't realize how great something is until you watch it back years later, or a movie will come out. And let's say the movie doesn't really do very well, but then years later, all of a sudden, the movie becomes a cult classic. I knew the minute that he slammed Cena that this was one of the greatest promos I'd ever seen. I didn't need to wait 3 years to look back and go, you know what? That was one of the greatest promos of all time. Like, I knew when I watched it, like, this was fucking awesome. And this was one of the best that I had ever seen. Because it just worked. It worked on every level. It was this heartfelt promo from this guy that had been around forever. And he got you to believe, and he got you to not feel sorry for him, but just kind of be sad that it was all over. Even though I'm sure myself and a lot of people for years were like, aside from the Hall of Pain run, which was good, I enjoyed him during the Hall of Pain run. Aside from that, Mark Henry coming on TV, it was like, oh God, like, ugh, But here he was, and people chanting one more match. They wanted to see him come back, and he's talking about his family, and the tears are flowing. It was so perfect. It was so effective. It was so perfect. I knew the minute he slammed Cena that it was one of the greatest promos I'd ever seen. And it got me... it shouldn't have, because it's wrestling, and I should be conditioned not to believe a damn thing that they tell me. If they tell you so-and-so is going to retire tonight, chances are they're not retiring, okay? Look at what they tried to do with Sasha Banks this week. I didn't buy that for a second, and part of that is this damn Mark Henry promo. That's probably a big part of the reason why I didn't believe it with Sasha. I should have known something was up with Henry when they showed him backstage. He was talking to different people. He was hyping up that he was going to retire. And like when Edge retired, that was a legitimate, serious retirement. I don't remember them showing Edge backstage, going up to people, shaking their hands, playing it up like, this is Edge's final night. He went out there and he dropped the bomb. You kind of thought maybe something was up, but he went out there, he dropped that bomb, and I remember feeling bad because I didn't buy what Edge was saying until like halfway maybe or a little more than halfway through his promo. I kind of realized, oh shit, like he's actually retiring. I was so jaded and I was so conditioned to believe that this can't possibly be happening that I didn't buy it when it happened. So the Henry thing, having fallen for it, has made me even more cynical and skeptical when it comes to stuff like this. I blame this promo for that. But Cena's laying there on the mat. He looks down at Cena. He's yelling at him, "You think it's that easy? I got a lot left in the tank." And I look back on this promo and I just think to myself, what a shame. What a shame that he was just used as a placeholder opponent for Cena to get Cena to SummerSlam. Yeah, I know they had their big plan for Cena and Daniel Bryan, and they had a great match, and I love the Authority swerve. This was before I realized the Authority was not going anywhere for 3 years. I actually love what they did that night at SummerSlam. I thought it was great, the whole Randy Orton turn. So I get that. They had their plans. The timing just wasn't right. But that doesn't make it any less of a shame. You know, that they had John Cena not just beat him, but they had him tap out Mark Henry in the STF. He tapped this guy out like he was just a dude on the roster. And I was at that Money in the Bank show, too. That was the one in Philadelphia. People wanted to see Mark Henry win that match. And to have him tap out to Cena was just such a waste of a great turn, especially since they turned him back babyface the night after. You know, it's like, when he did this to Cena, it's like, oh, here we go. You know, Hall of Pain Mark Henry is back. He's going to go on one last monster ripper run here. And it lasted a few weeks. Cena tapped him out. The next night, he's back on TV, and he turns face. The Shield attacked him, and babyface Mark Henry is back. And, of course, they did nothing with him after that. And it was like none of this ever happened. But it did. And it's one of the greatest promos of all time. So next week, we are up to number 7. We'll reveal number 7 on the list next week as we count down to, in my opinion, the greatest promo or interview in WWE history that will culminate on our 9-year anniversary podcast at the beginning of November. So we'll have some fun with this counting down every single week and letting you guys try to guess what might be on this list. So follow me on Twitter at Solomonster. That's the place to go. I will be live tweeting during Backlash. I live tweet during Raw every single week. You can vote in the polls that I throw up. Thumbs up, thumbs down. You can make your voice be heard. Also, don't forget, we have a private discussion group on Facebook. It is the full title of this podcast, Solomonster Sounds Off. Very popular group on Facebook. Well over 3,700 members. If you are someone who has been waiting in queue for a while because you have to be approved in order to get into the group, drop me a line or send me a tweet and let me know, because I'm sure we have a lot of people who are kind of stuck in the muck. We have a long waiting list of people to get into the group. It's up over 1,400 people now. Very selective in terms of who comes into the group and who doesn't, because when you just let everybody in or you have a public group, it's just mass chaos and things don't end well. So we run a very tight ship there, but if you have been waiting in queue for a while, please drop me a note, let me know, and we'll get you in there. Also, don't forget, you can make a PayPal donation anytime on thesolomonster.com. If you want to hear your name, shout it out here on this show. Get yourself a wrestling nickname. This is a podcast that's listened to by a lot of people every week all over the world. You can make a $10 or more donation via PayPal. Just click the button on the website, and we'll get that taken care of for you. And show some love in iTunes and Stitcher. We are a five-star rated podcast. In iTunes, you can rate us, you can leave us a review. Best thing you can really do in terms of supporting the show, is just besides listening, is to just keep spreading the word. If you like what you hear, let your friends know, family members, if you think they might be interested in hearing about wrestling every single week, if they're into podcasts and stuff, if they've never heard the show before. We've gotten some new listeners from the Rolling Stone feature a few weeks ago, which is very cool, so welcome to all of our new listeners. But just keep spreading the word, and also big thanks to TV Trax. TV Trax continues to be a big supporter of myself in this podcast. You can see all of the clips from not only my show, but other shows as well on his channel every single week. So definitely check his channel out, and check our own channel out. You know, if you can't get enough Sound Off content, there is bonus Sound Off extra audio on our YouTube channel. Tons of interviews, pay-per-view reviews. There might even be one that goes up tonight. Or first thing tomorrow morning. So if you type in the username on there as The Solomonster, it's probably the easiest way to find the channel, and just click the subscribe button, and that way when new content goes up, you'll get a notification letting you know that there is a new video up. So I think that's about it. I'm all out of plugs. Episode 461 is on tap for next weekend. Until then, be well, stay safe, and we will see you right back here again for more Sound Off next weekend. Until then, take care, guys.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. The Sala Monster sounds off.
This Impact show has moved so many times. It's got more fucking moves than Bruno Mars, this show does. Don't believe me, just watch. Impact started out on Friday, then moved to Saturday, Thursday, then they moved it to Monday. They got slaughtered, so they moved it back to Thursday, then they moved it to Wednesday, Friday again, then back to Wednesday, Tuesday, and now back to Thursday. It's like the Big Show of TV shows. It's turned 1,000 times already, and the only time people pay any attention to it is when it makes them laugh.
Monster Sounds Off. Since 2007, The Sala Monster Sounds Off. Available at thesalamonster.com, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, and more.
Sala Monster Sound Off.